Our guest today is Sister Eugenia O'Loughlin. She is a retired Ursuline teacher and freelance writer.
Thank you, Minister Nell. Oh, I feel highly privileged in being asked to make this recording. I would like also to thank Sister Louise, who has helped me in getting the material organized. She acted really as my eyes because I can no longer see. I will be unable to use cards in any way since I can't see. So what I say will have to be recorded from memory. I would like to also thank my sister, Mrs. Shan Durkin, for the permission to verify facts about some of the early things that I am going to record. I would like to say this is not a scholarly dissertation. It is simply a human interest story, and I hope that you, Mr. Nell, and that anyone who listens to it will enjoy it, the reading or listening as much as I have done in the preparation. And as Julie Andrews says in one verse, or rather sings in one of her songs, in The Sound of Music, since it is a story, we will have to begin with the beginning. I'm going to take you back to the year 1866. The place is a small town in Arkansas, which is called Jenny Lind. Jeannie Hamilton and her mother, Sarah, were just coming out of the general store where they had been doing some shopping. As they emerged, Jeannie noticed the cowboy who always seemed to be there every time she came to do her shopping. She knew he was handsome. She could see very clearly and hear the pounding of his high-top boots. She noticed the Levi's tucked into the top of the boots. His denim shirt was open at the top, and his bandana handkerchief was tied cowboy fashion around his neck. She was a little amused when she noticed how his shoulder-length auburn hair bounced up and down as he walked. She knew his face was handsome, although his big sombrero hid it, because she had seen that face several times before. She was impressed by the high forehead, his well-shaped nose above the auburn mustache, and she knew quite well that he had very white teeth because he had grinned at her many times when they passed, but they had never met. As he turned the corner, Jeannie turned to her mother and said, "Ma, that's the man I'm going to marry." Her mother had never seen him before, but she knew of him because everybody in that small town knew about Frank O'Loughlin, the dashing young cowboy who had done a lot of traveling and was remarkable for his riding and his love of horses. Mrs. Hamilton looked at Jeanie and said to her, "What made you think of such a thing as that? You don't even know that man, and besides, he's a papist." But Jeanie said, "It makes no difference. I don't know how or when, but someday I'm going to marry him." Time passed, and early in the next spring, Jeanie's mother died. Then she, the 15-year-old daughter, the third child of the family who had been born to Hugh and Jane Hamilton shortly after their coming to America from Scotland, took over the family chores. She knew very well how to do everything with keeping a house. Her bread was the best bread that anyone could ever bake. She was very adept at baking cake. And their little cabin where she lived with Paul and her younger sister, Sarah, and her brother, Huey, was kept immaculately clean. Then one Sunday afternoon, Jeanie, dressed in a dark red velvet dress that her mother had made for her, went to the village well to get water. She was startled when a man's voice said to her, "May I get that for you?" She turned to him, and here was her cowboy, the very first time that they had ever really met. And she replied, "I can do it myself." He said, "I can do it easier. Please let me." And she yielded all the time, rejoicing in her heart that it had come about that way. Then he asked to be allowed to carry the buckets home. She consented, and there Frank met Jeanie's father, Hugh Hamilton, for the first time. Paul and Frank were delighted in one sense to meet because Pa had heard about him from Jenny. And when Frank asked if he might court Jenny, or rather, Jenny, Pa replied that he would have to first know something more about him. He said, "You probably are not aware, but we, my family and I, are very good Methodists, and I hear that you're a Papist. And if this can be ironed out, I will give you the required permission." Frank assured him that could be taken care of and the permission was given. The courtship went as courtships do, and while the couple didn't meet too many times, they really did get to know each other. And finally, Frank came to the point where he began questioning Jeannie as to how she might feel about marrying a papist and raising the children Catholics. She said there would be no trouble there. Naturally, no engagement was made at this time, but finally, Jeannie received a letter. It was a very special letter for many reasons. First of all, she had never received a letter. She noticed that it was on very good stationery, and down in the corner, the left-hand corner of the envelope was a red rose. She turned the paper over, the envelope over and over, trying to decide from whom it could have come. And then she said, well, it could only be from Frank. But would he really write to me? So with a heart beating hard, she opened the envelope, and it was from Frank, and it was tantamount to a proposal. She read it a second time. Then, because she had a very special errand to do, she slipped the envelope into her apron pocket and turned the pocket towards the wall so the letter would be sure not to fall out. Then she went her way. When she returned, she was really dismayed. There stood Paul, reading her letter, how it fell out of her pocket, how he got hold of it, she never knew. But she knew from the look on his face that he wasn't very happy about it. And as she came in, he said, Jeannie, what's going on here? Doesn't that young whippersnapper know that he should talk to me first? You write to him right now and tell him so. This Jeannie promptly did, and a letter came back post haste to Paul telling him that he, Frank, had really intended talking to him first, but he wanted to know before he did that how Jeannie felt about it, and that he himself would be there in a few days. Since Frank was in Fort Smith at the time, he had to take the little train between Jenny Lind and Fort Smith to get there. When he arrived, he and Pa sat down to talk, and at first Pa objected to his asking Jenny to marry him, because for the first reason, he didn't want her living on a ranch. Frank assured him that he had already left the ranch, that he had secured work in a coal mine. So that question was settled. Then Pa brought up the subject of the difference in religion. Frank explained that that could be arranged when he would get a dispensation because of it's being a mixed marriage. But he added that he would want any children they had to be raised as Catholics. Pa agreed to that. Then Frank assured him that if Jeannie consented to marry him, he would never influence her in any way to become a Catholic. With Pa's permission obtained, Frank went in search of Jeannie. He didn't have to go too far, and the two met, and they decided to go out to a place near the well where they knew there was a log. And sitting on the log, they began making plans for the wedding. And they set the date for January the 31st in the following year, which would be 1889. And Frank said to Jeannie, "Now, since both of our mothers are dead, you will need someone to help you with your trousseau and preparing the things that you will need for housekeeping. Would you be willing to let me ask my Auntie O'Day and my two cousins to help?" Jeannie was delighted, and before long, she and the Auntie O'Day and the two cousins who had come to Jenny then went back to Portsmouth and did a lot of shopping. They came back laden with all sorts of things. Everything that Auntie O'Day felt would need to be made up before the wedding. Jeannie had a small trunk. She pulled this out from some hidden corner, and as Auntie O'Day and Kate and Delia worked and sewed, they began packing the little trunk. And finally, even the wedding dress was completed and hung carefully in a corner where it would be well protected. Then Jeannie let Frank know that that things were pretty well prepared, and would he come to make the very last arrangements. This he did in haste. Frank came as he had promised. The little trunk was so filled with the things that Auntie O'Day and the cousins had helped Jeannie make that Jeannie had to sit on it before Frank could really get it fastened tightly. Then he told her that he had taken care of all the arrangements and that the wedding would take place in the little church rectory in Fort Smith, and that he and Auntie O'Day and all the cousins, and there were a lot of them, would meet her at the station on the morning of earlier the morning break, I'd say around noon, on the 31st. That was just a few days before the 31st, when after Frank left, Jeannie noticed a small velvet box lying on the table. She was almost afraid to open it. She knew it was Frank's wedding gift to her, but what would it be? It couldn't be a ring because the box was too long. And after a few minutes' hesitation, she opened it and she saw lying there on velvet the most beautiful brooch she had ever seen in her life. And she clapped her hands delightedly and vowed that any time she dressed to go any place, that would be part of her apparel. And almost before Jeannie knew it, the 31st had arrived. When she awoke in the morning, she saw that a few flakes of snow were falling, but that didn't make any difference to her. She bathed and dressed partially. Then she, since there was no one there to help her, she arranged her long black hair in a French knot at the nape of her neck and combed out the bangs that she had had up in curlers. And then she went to the corner and with trembling fingers took down from its peg the corn silk wedding gown. It was beautiful, made in the Polonaise style of that time. She slipped it carefully over her head, and as she admired the row of tiny little buttons marching down the front, the loops at the side made her waist even slenderer than she had thought it was, and the tips of her high-buttoned shoes peeped out as she walked towards the mirror to put on the final touches. Being satisfied with herself, she took the straw poke bonnet, put it carefully on her head, and tied the ribbons under her chin. By that time, Paul was getting a little anxious, and he called, "Jeannie, if you don't hurry, we're going to miss the train." So she quickly walked to the door where she met him and little Sarah and Huey, and the four of them went to the station where they boarded the train. Even Paul could hardly believe that this elegantly dressed young lady could be his daughter. She was truly beautiful. Before they reached the station, and Jeannie had been looking out the window long before they got up there, she saw all the old days and all the cousins gathered on the platform. And in a minute, Frank came hurrying to meet the train even before it stopped. She galloped. She knew he was handsome, but she had never seen him dressed in anything but the cowboy outfit. His shiny black shoes, his dark, reedy black trousers with gray stripes, his cutaway coat, his white starched shirt and black bow tie made him look out of this world. And then when she saw the auburn hair scarcely showing below the black derby, she could hardly wait to rush into his arms. By that time, the train had stopped, and he lifted her down carefully. And all the cousins gathered around, and everybody got to talking, and nobody listened until Frank finally said, "We've got to get moving. This wedding is scheduled for 1:30, and it's almost that time. Let's go." So they all lined up and started. The church was just a couple of blocks from the station, and because it was a mixed marriage, the ceremony would be performed in the shabby little rectory. The guest room had been prepared for the wedding, and the bride and groom stood before the priest in his black cassock, white surplice, and white stole. He was waiting there patiently with the book for the wedding ceremonial. The wedding began and went very smoothly until just before Father pronounced Frank and Jeannie, man and wife. Pa got up, walked to the pair and said, "Pardon me, Reverend, I would like to kiss my daughter once more before she marries a papist." The permission was given, the kiss was given, and the ceremony was soon concluded, and the wedding party proceeded to the hotel where the wedding dinner was to be served. When all were seated, the dinner was served, and it was delicious. They had a hilarious time, everybody enjoying every minute of it. Then finally, after sitting there for a couple of hours, the ladies decided that they would take a stroll down the street, because it really was something to be in a city as big as Fort Smith. And so they left and went window shopping and taking a good stroll. In the meantime, the men were enjoying themselves with probably a few glasses of beer, certainly smoking, and discussing and settling all the problems of the world. Suddenly, Pa realized that a very long time had passed. Where were those ladies? What were they doing? He was going to go out and look for them. When he rose, Frank rose also, and both of them moved towards the door. Just before they reached it, the ladies came in. And the pa said, "Jeannie, where have you been? I've been worried about you. I feel like boxing your ears." But Frank walked over to Jeannie, put his hands on her shoulder, and said, "Nobody boxes Jeannie now. She belongs to me." And then Jeannie, standing on tiptoe, put her arms around his Frank's neck and gave him the kiss which she had denied him once before, right after their engagement, when that he had asked her. Now she realized she was his wife. They were married, and he certainly deserved that kiss. When it began to darken a little, Auntie O'Day and all the cousins departed, and Frank and Jeannie went to the room in the hotel where they were going to spend the few days of their honeymoon. These days passed quickly, and they went back to the little cabin, and they went to the little cabin that Frank had purchased and Jenny was going to now make into a home. Jenny set to work at once, making it into a real home, making curtains and getting out the things from the little trunk and making the place as home-like as she could. Frank went to work every morning in the mine, and sometimes the aunties and the cousins came to visit. Then one day, Jeannie said to Auntie O'Day, "I am going to need some baby things. Would you please help me make them?" Oh, Auntie O'Day was delighted. Nothing could please her more. So again they went shopping. Things were purchased, and again sewing went on in Jenny's land. And married life proceeded as married lives usually do. Then on the 19th of December, 1889, my father, because now I can call him that, was in the yard sawing wood. The lady who had been taking care of my mother came to the door and said, "You, Frank!" And he dropped the saw and came running. When he got to the steps, Mary said to him, "You have a little girl. Are you sorry?" He said, "Sorry for what?" And she said, "But it's a girl." He said, "Good Lord, no. I'll be glad if they're all girls." He rushed in to see Mama and me, and when he poked at me with his forefinger, I grabbed it and held on, and then we were friends for the rest of our days. And then, because Papa was so willing to have all girls, God sent him and my mother 4 boys and 4 girls. My mother, keeping her word, her promise, rather, to see that the children would be raised Catholics, took me the first time the priest came to Jenny Lind, which he didn't do very often, and I was baptized. My father at that time was working from 6 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night. He was, I'm sure, very tired, and I think he felt that Mama could very well take care of such details as having children baptized, and he left it to her. Time went on, and in 2 years, my brother Hugh was born. When he was about 2 years old, and I must have been about 4, I had just gotten up and was still in my long white nightgown when, for some reason or other, I got mad at Mama, and I said to her, "I'm not going to stay in this house anymore." She had never studied child psychology, but she knew how to practice it. All she said was, "Well, nothing's stopping you." So I grabbed up my little red chair, swung it over my arm, put my rag doll in the other arm, hiked up my nightgown, and started down the street. In the meantime, Mom, although I didn't know it, was watching me from behind the curtain. I marched myself down to the end of the block. By that time, I suppose my legs were too tired, so I turned around and went back. Mom didn't say anything. I climbed into my chair at the table. She served me my breakfast, which I ate in silence. And little as I was, I must have had a realization that in that house, I depended on my mother. By the time I was 5 years old, we had moved to Springfield, Illinois, and it was there that the most important incident of my whole life occurred. We lived next door to a family who were Catholics. They had a little girl, Laura, who was about my own age, and Laura and I played a great deal together. And one day, I'm not sure how it came about, but Laura said something to me about God. I had never heard of God. So I rushed into the house, and I still remember this part of it. My mother was ironing. My father was sitting over by the window reading his newspaper. And I stepped around in front of Mama, and I said to her, "Mama, who is God?" She set the iron down in dismay and looked at my dad, and she said, "Frank, did you hear what she said?" He nodded, and she said, "Well, we can't let her grow up like this." She said, "I have never taught them my prayers. I couldn't teach them Catholic prayers because I didn't know anything." And she said, "What are we going to do about it?" And my father didn't know right then what could be done. He had been so busy trying to earn a living for us
but he just had to depend upon Mama, and he forgot that she didn't know all these things. So during the afternoon, Mama worried about the thing, and she was just determined that things would have to be different. So she finally went over to Mrs. Mack, the lady next door, and she told her the whole story. And she said to her, "What can I do? I just can't let this go on this way." And Mrs. Mack said, "Well," she said, "I don't think that I could help you like a priest could." And she said, "If you would like to go and talk to our pastor, I'll be glad to take you." So Mama said, yes, she would be glad to go. So Mrs. Mack took her, and the father and she had several conversations. He got the whole background and got the picture. And he said, "Well," he said, "if you really want to know all about these things, the best way to do would be to take a Baltimore Catechism and study a question and answer. And when you come across things that you don't understand and you'd like to have explained, come back and I'll help you as much as I can." So she took the catechism, she went home with it, and she began reading. When she came to a place that she needed an explanation for, she'd go back and talk to Father about it. And of course, he incidentally gave her more and more information. Finally, she knew the catechism almost from memory. And by the time she had finished these talks with Father and had studied the catechism thoroughly, she began to see that she believed the Catholic Church to be the true church. And she told Father that. And she said, "What do I do now?" And he said, "Well, were you ever baptized?" And she said, "Yes, my mother, a devout Methodist, had all of us baptized when we were infants." And he said, "Well, usually when a person comes into the church who has been baptized, we give them what we call conditional baptism," because he said, "There are certain things required. We want to be sure that those have been included." He said, "Would you want to do that?" Yes, she would. And she was converted. And then my life as a Catholic began. She began teaching my brother and me our Catholic prayers, and of course brother had been baptized too. We called him brother because I didn't want him when he first came. And he became brother to the whole world after that. His real name was Hugh. And by and by, Mama was ready for baptism. She received it. She made her first Holy Communion. And then the whole family went to church together. Later on, when my father was dying in 1914, he said to my mother, "Jane, if I ever get to heaven, it will be through your prayers and good example." No more devout Catholic ever existed than my mother. All through her life, she was the one who influenced us most. Shortly after this, we moved again, this time to Sparta, Illinois. These moves were necessary because my father, being a coal miner, had to follow the mines and find work wherever mines were open. I must have been around 8 or 10 at that time, and I have from the beginning, that is from the time I was 6, attended the public schools because there were no Catholic schools any place that we, in which we lived. Even in Sparta, there were no Catholic schools. And I was nearing the time when I would be eligible to make my first Holy Communion. And we were now permitted to receive Holy Communion in those days until we had passed our 12th birthday. And in order that I be well prepared, there were only 3 of us in that First Communion class. So in order that we be well prepared, Father Van Delft, our pastor, took us for instructions as soon as school left out, and we went each day for our catechism lessons and for explanations of our faith and for the Bible stories, the beginning with the Old Testament and running into the New. In addition, my mother saw to it that I studied my catechism perfectly, and she helped me with the questions outside of the catechism that I wanted to know. Then by August the 15th, Father felt that we 3 in the First Communion class were ready. In the meantime, my mother had made me a beautiful white organdy dress with lots of tucks, tiny tucks, and very narrow, beautiful lace. I had also gotten new slippers with shiny buckles, and of course we wore long black hose. On the morning of my First Communion day, Mama watched me carefully lest I break my fast, because in those days we were required to fast from midnight until after Holy Communion the next day. Now people have the opportunity of taking solid food up to within an hour of the time of receiving Holy Communion. And water is permitted even a few minutes before. Of course, coffee or other liquids of that type are forbidden. But to go back now to the First Communion morning, Mama helped me dress carefully. She adjusted
No, first of all, she saw that my curls were just in the right place. Then she adjusted my Liberty silk veil over my head. It fell to the tail of my dress. Then she put my white wreath on. And for the first time, I wore fingerless mitts. And I felt that I was really grown up. Mama didn't want me to look in the mirror because she wanted me to be sure that the important thing in this day was the fact that Jesus was coming to me for the first time. And after a few good looks at myself, I tried to concentrate on that fact so that when we got to church, I think I was properly awed with the thought that God in a few minutes would be coming to me, a 12-year-old girl. After Mass, Father helped us make our Thanksgiving, and the whole family went home together. We lived at the edge of town at that time on what was really a small farm. So we had a grape arbor. Mama told me to wait in the parlor until she called me for breakfast, which really was breakfast and dinner combined, because it was pretty late in the morning. Then she sent my brother Hugh to get me, and to my amazement, the table had been set under the grape arbor, and never do I smell ripe purple grapes without remembering that scene. On the table, Mama had spread her most precious white tablecloth. The best silver had been brought out. Her treasured dishes were there, and everything, it seemed to me, under the sun that you could want to eat was on that table. And I was given the place of honor where Papa usually sat, at the top of the table. We had a grand time talking about everything and anything, and we sat for hours at the table. When we were finished and had said our grace, I was pretty sure that Mama would say to me, "Now, Mary Jane, go in and take off your good dress and put on your school dress," because in our house we had three types of clothing. We had school clothes, we had work clothes, and we had Sunday clothes. And when we came home from school, we got our work clothes out and we wore them until bedtime. They were worn only to school. Then our Sunday clothes were just for Sunday or big occasions, and this was a big occasion. So Mama said, "If you're careful, you can wear your dress the rest of the day." And I was so happy I was walking on pink clouds. Shortly after that, we made another move, this time to a small house just outside Maryville, which was about an hour's ride to Collinsville. And Collinsville was where my mother wanted to eventually go because there they had a sister school, and she was most anxious that we be put into a Catholic school as soon as possible. And very soon we did move to Collinsville. By that time, I was ready to enter the seventh grade, and we had had some additions to our family. Besides myself, Hugh, my brother, my sister Shan had been born while we were in Springfield. Frances had come along, another sister, and Tom had arrived by that time, and there were several of us ready to go to school. So my mother and I went to the Catholic school office to register, and while I had always had in the back of my mind the thought of being a sister, it was nebulous because I didn't know much about them. I only knew that my mother esteemed them very highly. But I was determined now I would really find out about them. So we duly registered, and when we came out, I said to my mother, "Well, that's one order I would never join." And my mother said, "Why not?" And I said, "Well, they're so wrapped up." The Ursulines at that time were still wearing the real old style habit. I said, "They're so wrapped up, all you can see is their noses." And Mom said, "So it's the dress you're thinking about." And that really caught me up short, and I really began to think deeply and seriously about this thing. There were, I think, three of us in that Catholic school, myself, my brother Hugh, and Sarah. I think Frances wasn't yet old enough to start school. I studied my seventh grade teacher very carefully, still thinking pretty seriously about being a sister. Yet I was determined I had to learn a great deal more about them before I would take such a tremendous step, because I knew that it would be that. Then by the time I reached the eighth grade, or maybe a few months before that, I had begun thinking seriously about this particular order of sisters, the Ursulines. I didn't know any other orders, but I was interested in these nuns, or sisters, because they were my teachers. By the time I got into the eighth grade, I had become so accustomed to them, that I felt that I could speak to my eighth grade teacher, at least find out something about these sisters. I knew what they did. I had seen they were very prayerful. I knew they were excellent teachers. I knew, above all things, that they were concerned and cared about each other. But further than that, I didn't know. So I managed to appoint myself the Mother Agnes's after school assistant. I was saying, help her clean the boards, and they had no janitor. So we really cleaned the classroom and got it ready for the next day. And then in our casual talks, I asked her about the order. I said, tell me something about the Ursulines. And she said, yes, I'll be glad to. So she told me that the order had been founded in 1535 by St. Angela Merici in Brescia, Italy. It was at that time the world was in a pretty bad state of disorder, and only boys really got a thorough education. Girls, especially poor girls, who could not afford, whose families could not afford a governess or a special teacher, were simply trained in household chores. And Angela felt that if the world was to be made a better place in which to live, all girls should be educated, because without good mothers, how can a world be made better? So she said to herself, I think I'll just begin teaching the girls around here, and then maybe something will come of that. And in the meantime, she was really getting special graces of light, I'm sure, from God. And she was more and more convinced that this was the work that God wanted her to do. So she began with the little girls in the neighborhood, and pretty soon other women, seeing what good was coming of this, joined her. And before too long, there were 12 of them. And at that time, they lived in their own homes. They met maybe once a month to pray together and to report what things had been going on. And then gradually, it became a little community, and they decided that it would be better if they could live together, and that they did. And then St. Angela called it the Company of St. Ursula. She had a great devotion to St. Ursula, because she had been a young girl who had been martyred for her faith of many years before. So St. Angela, because she was humble and didn't want the order given her the company, because she didn't foresee it would grow into an order, she didn't want to give it her name. So she called it the Company of St. Ursula. And then from that, they began calling it the Ursulines, or Ursulines. The little company spread rapidly throughout Italy, then into France, and then into other parts of the world, that is, in Europe. And the sisters were doing wonderful work. And they, by that time, they were really living together. And the pupils were beginning to come to them instead of their going out to meet them. During these early days, the sisters were not cloistered, but later on, because of the disturbed condition of many cities, and it wasn't safe for women to be going out on the street alone. St. Charles Borromeo, who was either a bishop or a cardinal at the time and was connected with the company, thought it would be better to cloister the nuns, and that is what happened. And we were pretty strictly cloistered until about 1960, but I will go back to that later. As the little company spread, the New World had been discovered, and Blessed Mary, we call her Blessed because someday she will be canonized, Blessed Mary of the Incarnation and Ursuline in a community in Toulouse, France, was burning with zeal to do something about the girls who would be in these places in the New World. And of course, the first settlements were made in Canada. So she asked and got the permission to come herself and bring a small group of sisters with her to Quebec. And that happened in 1639, I'm pretty sure. And they are still there, still doing good work. And her main object in coming, we must remember, was to teach, first of all, the little Indian girls, and then to accept as pupils the children of the settlers, the girls of the settlers who had come there. Then, later on, in 1727, that was before New Orleans was even a part of what is now the United States, another group of Ursulines made up of sisters from different convents who had volunteered to come, started the first convent of any kind in what is now the United States. They are flourishing, and it is necessary that we remember that the settlement in Quebec, the settlement in New Orleans, had no contact whatsoever. They were independent mother houses. And gradually, other orders began sending sisters to the New World. And finally, groups settled in St. Louis, and they came from Austria. I have to mention them specially because among ourselves, we called that house in St. Louis our grandmother. From that house, later on, when they had secured enough subjects, they sent nuns to Alton, Illinois, and that's where I entered. But there are some things to tell before we get there. I thanked Mother Agnes for the information she had given me, and I asked her if some other time she would tell me more. So little by little, I learned about the convents being opened in Alton, and I learned a great deal about what sisters did and how they lived, and just many things that drew me towards them. And in the meantime, I began thinking I'd better say something to my confessor about this, because it was a thing I couldn't decide all by myself, even if I felt that I had a vocation. So I began talking to Father Degenhardt about it. From time to time, I'd ask him something in connection with it, and he got to know me very, very well. And he was watching, although I didn't know it, the progress of my vocation. And then one day, sometime I suppose early in that eighth grade year, the music teacher, whom I met quite often because I had become the sister's shopper, and I would take whatever I had purchased to the front door, and she would deliver them to the sister in the kitchen, said to me, "Mary Jane, when was the last time you thought of being a sister?" I was startled. None of them had ever said anything to me, indirectly or directly. And I looked at her in surprise, and I thought to myself, "What made her say that?" And then I said to her, "Well, sister, I think about it very, very often." And she said, "Well, you keep on thinking about it and pray about it and talk to your confessor." And I said, "Well, I think I've been doing just that." And I was ready to go home, and I told Mama about this conversation, and of course I really was walking on pink clouds, because I thought to myself, "Well, at least they must think I'm good enough to be a sister, because I didn't know that you became a sister to become good, but that you had to be real good before you could be one." And when I told Mama, she was very happy, and she encouraged me all she could. And we talked more or less. And then finally I said to Mother Agnes, I think I really would like to be a sister. And I think I'd like to be an Ursuline." And she wanted to know why, and I told her, just as I said a few minutes ago, because I had studied the sisters. I had seen that they were prayerful, that they were loved God, that they were very good teachers. And by that time, I began to see that they were really influencing people for good. And if I could do that, it would be wonderful. And I had that in mind. And then I said, "And I noticed too that you really care for each other." And at that stage in my life, that was a great thing. Because when you're young, you're looking for love. And it was the kind of love that I really wanted. And she said, "Well, I think it wouldn't hurt if you wrote to the superior in Alton." And in the meantime, I suppose she'd been telling Mother Ducey about me. So I wrote to her, and I told her just what I had told Mother Agnes. And I wanted to know how soon I could come. although I wasn't quite excited, but I thought, well, I'll find out for sure if they really would take me. So she wrote back and she told me that I had better wait for a while. I was just finishing the eighth grade. I had all my high school to do, and she told me, if we did accept you, you would have to go to school at the Borders. Well, I didn't know exactly what that entailed, but I thought, well, I guess I could stand that. So I wrote back then and told her that I wanted to come then. If I couldn't come then, I would try to enter someplace else. There is a time in our lives, I think, in God's plan, when you must do certain things, and that seemed to be the time that he was calling me. And so she said, well, finally, she said, well, if you're willing to do as I suggested, I think we could accept you and we'll see that you get your high school work. So we, of course, I just told Mother Agnes and they were quite happy about the thing. And I told my family and I told Dad was there, but evidently he didn't give too much credence to it. I suppose he thought it was just a young girl's notion, and he didn't pay that very much attention. And then after school was out, my mother and I began making things to get me ready. Sister had sent me a list of the things that I would need. And we got my trunk and began preparing things. All summer long, even when we were working on my things, getting ready to go to the convent, I had fearful temptations. There was the human side of the thing to look at, which was the desire to have a family of my own, a husband, a house to take care of, children, and all the other things that I felt I would be giving up or leaving if I went to the convent. Then on the other hand was the powerful spiritual pull, which made me realize that if I had a vocation, I certainly ought to follow it. And since I felt so strongly that that's what God wanted me to do, he would certainly give me the grace to follow that vocation. At night, and they were the worst times, when I would kneel by the window where I loved to say my night prayers and look up at the sky, I would think, but what if there isn't any God? What if I'm doing all this and it's not going to be worth anything? What? And then I said to myself, how can I, with my small mind, begin to doubt that there could be a God and all the things that flow from that, when men like St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Thomas More and St. Jerome and all the other great saints of the church with their giant intellects could accept that. So then I couldn't settle the thing. I couldn't talk to Mama about it. I didn't feel she'd understand. So finally I said, well, I'll just go talk to Father Degenhart, and then he's going to say, okay, you have no vocation, just stay home, and I'll say, goody. So I went to him and I told him the whole story, and he looked real hard at me and he said, Mary Jane, I am more convinced now than ever that you have a vocation. He said, the devil must foresee, he has to foresee that you will be doing some good work, and he is doing his best to prevent it. Now he said, my advice to you would be go as quickly as you can. On the evening of August the 28th, 1905, which the day before I was planning to leave, the neighbors gave a surprise party for me. We had a hilarious time. Everybody, even my father, I think, enjoyed it. When the party was over and I had gone to my room to get ready for bed, because I knew we were leaving early in the morning, I heard my father and mother having a rather heated argument. I wasn't concerned until I heard my name, and then I knew they were just talking about me, and I knew my father was objecting to my going, and my mother was pleading on my behalf. And finally, Mama said to my father, when he said, she's too young, my mother replied, I'm pretty sure if she wanted to get married, you wouldn't object. Well, he had no answer to that. So then he said, well, who all is going? And Mom said, we're all going. And what time are you going? At 5 o'clock in the morning. Well, if you're all going, I'm going too. So early the next morning, the whole O'Loughlin family, eight of us, boarded the Interurban, which would take us to Alton. None of us had ever been, had even never seen a big convent. And I don't know what the portress thought when she saw that whole gang standing there on the steps. She admitted us graciously, and Soon different nuns came in to visit us, and everybody was so kind and so good. And we spent the whole day there, had dinner together, and my family were planning to leave on the 4 o'clock Interurban. When it got nearly time for the car, for them to start for the car, my dad stood up and walked over to me, and he was never demonstrative, but this time he was. He put his arms around me and he said, Mary Jane, if you can be a sister like these sisters, I'll never be sorry for letting you come. They proceeded to the Interurban, and I sat on the convent porch and cried. Of course, they didn't know that. When they reached home, which took about an hour, and that trip was like a funeral. The one in the morning going had been a real picnic. We had had loads and loads of fun. But now they were going home without someone. When they reached home, it dawned on my sister Sham that I would never be coming home again. She was only 10, and she threw herself on the floor and sobbed her heart out. On September the 5th, 1905, I received the cape and the cap of the postulant. Two other young ladies who were supposed to have joined me came later. In the reception of the postulant's attire, the ceremony was very short. The community prayed that with me that God would bless my undertaking, give me the grace of perseverance and the courage if I found that the religious life was not fitted to me or to it to me or I to it, that I would have the courage to return home, because we had really 2.5 years to decide definitely if we wanted to be sisters. The little cape was placed around my shoulders and the little lace cap placed on my head. Then the nuns greeted me and were very happy to have another young sister in their midst. Then the novice mistress conducted me to the novitiate, where I found there were several novices, a young nun who had not made her final vows. And in those days, these young nuns who were called juniors stayed in the novitiate until the time came 3 years later to make their final vows. And then when the other two young ladies came, we were 3 postulants. And during the time of our postulantship, I discovered I did not have to go to school with the boarders. During that period, I really had private tutors, because some of the retired sisters took me in hand and helped me. And I worked at my own rate of speed, which was pretty fast, and I covered quite a bit of my high school work. And during that time, we really studied the rules and constitutions, not in depth, but at least to get some idea of them. And we also learned the schedule of the house. And I found to my astonishment that we had 4 hours daily of prayer. And even the sisters who were in school observed, and we still do, that same schedule. That included time for meditation, for spiritual reading, for the recitation of the office, which is composed, it really now is called the breviary, and it's composed of psalms, hymns, and short prayers. And added to that, we said daily the rosary of Our Lady, at least 5 decades of it, and the Stations of the Cross. I learned, too, that there were hours of silence, and that was very new to me, because at home we never stopped talking, and we had such good times together that later on I found out that the neighbors called us the Laughing O'Loughlins. My mother was jolly, and in spite of all the hard things that she had to do, she still could find time to laugh, make us laugh, and we were forever, ever singing. I found that the novitiate was located in one wing of the building. They were rooms belonging to the convent proper, but they were set aside for the use of the postulants, the novices, and the juniors. The postulants' life covered a period of 6 months. Then we received the habit. Later on, I'm going to tell about that reception day, because it's a very beautiful thing. And then in 2 years' time, we made our first vows. We still remained in the novitiate ordinarily while we were juniors, although later on that was changed, but I will explain that too when we come to it. Each day we had 2 periods for recreation, an hour immediately after dinner, and again an hour in the evening. And on feast days and Sundays and holidays, there were also times of recreation. I remember very well my first 4th of July. That was a day of all-day recreation, which it was very uncommon. And we really were free that day to do pretty much the things that we wanted to do. So the novices and postulants formed a kitchen band, and we serenaded the community. Once a month, on the second Sunday, our family is permitted to visit us, and we always had gay times when they came. We could write letters during our postulancy very often, and the letters that we received were always of the greatest interest to us, because it kept us in touch with our family life and with what was going on outside the convent. Towards the beginning of January of 1905, we postulants began our preparation for reception day. The date was set for January 27th, 1906. During the first weeks of January, we were measured for our new habits our cinctures and our white veils and all the other new things that would go with our lives as sisters. All this preparation had to be made ahead of the retreat time, because before reception, we made an 8-day retreat, and during that time of prayer and consideration and silence, we tried very hard not to think of these things.